Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
Hey!
Hello, Mr. Howard.
Knut.
Did you think it was your birthday today?
Yeah. Dude, I've got... It's my inbox is so fucked. I got... First of all, I have such great friends, and it's such a great goofball cast of people that follow me on the Twitter and on the StockTwits and on... Well, that's it. I don't use the Facebook or the LinkedIn or the TikTok or the Snap. So... Yeah, for some reason I had it in my head that today was the 17th. So I do know my birthday is on the 17th. I don't know. I've just got something. You know, some days you just tell yourself something so much and you just believe it to be true. Kind of like that's how you become president, I guess. But so I just thought it was sin. I'm like, oh, I'm wishing myself happy birthday on Twitter. I got like 400 people I got to reply to. And then someone who has the same birthday as mine, because he's a good friend of mine, is like, well, that's weird. How did we get a day apart now? So then I had to go apologize. And wasted about 2 hours. Because, you know, I'm not busy. I only have 2 hours to fuck around on Twitter.
Of course you do.
But anyways, a couple Adderall later, and here I am. So I'm excited. I have Jim O'Shaughnessy on.
No, you don't.
I don't?
No. You have Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Well, we couldn't get Jim.
Oh, just funny.
I did that joke is only for Jim. No one else will get it.
Okay.
Yeah, Patrick knows. I'm excited at Patrick.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Patrick is tearing it up. So it's funny because I only know them a little while. And Jim, I think he's 30, 40 years older than me. But we hit it off. You know, we manscape. We talk about our kids. And we talk about risk. I've had him on the pod a few times. And Patrick has been tearing it up as a media investor. He's an investor slash media, a younger version of what I think I would do if I was his age. And I did it with video at Wallstrip. He's doing it with his podcast, Invest Like the Best or Invest with the Best. I think he should change the name because I always get those two wrong and I'll ask him that. But anyways, he has a lot of stuff going on. Kids, COVID, business, their firm, OSAM, and hopefully he'll talk about his new production today. So let's get him on the phone and see if he does. If not, we're going to talk older business ideas.
All right, I'll call him up.
Patrick.
Good afternoon. Good morning. Whatever it is there.
It is a gorgeous day in San Diego, Coronado. The smog, whatever it was that was wafting down from the north, has gone. So I'm seeing some sun, and that's a good thing. California's had a fucked up summer. Where are you today?
I'm at home, where I always am these days, and no smog here. Sure. On the East Coast, but enjoying it. Nice fall weather is upon us, and football is here.
Football is here. What did you think of the first week? Like, is it? I'm a football fanatic. Football's the only sport that kind of dragged me back. I didn't even watch Game 7 yesterday of basketball. It's the only sport that I think will drag me back. Like, I'm a hockey fan. I didn't even care about no fan hockey. I just said, you know, I'll wait till next year. Did football drag you back?
A little bit. It's so weird with the stands. I'm a Notre Dame fan. And so to see the stands so strangely empty for what looks like a scrimmage, but it's a real game, is a little bit, takes some adjusting to. But it was really fun to watch him play.
Now, have you done a lot of podcasts, or do you just give podcasts?
I don't do many. I hate being a guest, to be honest, just because I always worry that people will get wildly sick of me. So even on my show, when I do tell a story or something, because the guest asked me, I almost always delete it in post-production. So I try to be the question guy and not the answer person. But of course, for you, Howard, I'll make an exception.
Thank you. I'm the opposite. I delete my guests out just to get more Howie.
this will just be perfect. It'll be one long Howard soliloquy.
Yeah, we'll just insert some Jimisms in here, et cetera. So you are how old? 35?
35, yeah.
All right, so give... I'm a big fan, but let's tell people, the StockTwits audience may not know that much about you. I think they do. I share all the podcasts. So give people a little bit of background on Patrick.
Sure. I have a very unusual route through finance. I studied philosophy at Notre Dame, already mentioned. I spent the first 8 years of my career really doing quantitative research. So trying to understand what made public companies tick and build models for investing in those companies. I was not a trained statistician or data scientist, which is really the skill set required to go further than I could have gone in my 8 years. So after 8 years, I, having hit that natural ceiling of ability, kind of set out for the next thing, which was, you know, learn about other aspects beyond quant modeling of business and investing, which are my core passions. And I decided that I would do that search very much in public and that I need habits to be successful. I'm not good. I'm lazy if I don't have a habit. So I established a number of habits around how I could share what I was learning. The podcast, as you mentioned, happened to be the one that really caught fire and I think the audience most enjoyed. And I've been doing that ever since. So it's probably 5 years old or so. And that has led me really deeply into the world of technology and software. So I pretty quickly discovered that beyond the modeling exercise, the adjacent category of software development, tech, installing technology in old businesses, this was the thing I was most interested in. So that's led to us investing in software ourselves, you know, me personally and for my family. It's led to, in my period running OSAM, us turning the business, at least partially, you know, aggressively into a software business, building enterprise software ourselves. And now we'll be formally investing in early stage technology businesses through a new fund called Positive Sum that I'm sure we'll talk about. So I guess I would define my world as the intersection between investing, finance, technology, and software.
You know, bravo. I'm a fan. I don't know how to say this, but it's like in my world, like no one likes to say this, but we're all kind of copying each other and being inspired and evolving. You know, when I started Wall Street in 2006, I was inspired by Letterman, me doing stand-up and failing, Johnny Carson and Saturday Night Live and how bad CNBC was. And I kind of copied the Rocket Boom format. If Rocket Boom didn't exist, you know, I wouldn't have known that you're supposed to do a 3-minute YouTube show. I would have said, oh, let's do a half an hour show. So, you know, you copy formats and you do something original on top of it. I just never got into podcasts and just kept seeing your links and seeing the podcast and seeing the referrals. It took, you know, I don't know, 6 years of me getting hit over the head because I'd invested in podcast companies and lost money, you know, just way ahead of the curve. Even Twitter was a audio before it was Twitter. So everybody in podcasting has just been hit over the head for 15 years of the internet and no business. And I'm not even sure it really is a business other than a few people. But I look at the numbers from some small businesses that I've now invested in on the side in analytics. And it's just, the numbers are staggering. Not for each podcast, but just overall. What is it that got you excited about doing a podcast?
I guess I didn't think about it like that at all. It just happened to be that I was sort of doing a podcast anyway in private. I was having conversations where basically I just barrage people with questions about all sorts of stuff anyway as a normal part of my weekly routine. And I just happened to buy some mics and put them in front of us to capture those conversations. So I didn't know anything about podcasts when I started. I didn't set out to create a podcast strategically. I just asked myself, as I'm learning this stuff, what are the things I'm doing anyway? And is there like a frictionless way to capture, which by the way is what I recommend everyone do if they want to learn in public, figure out what you're doing already and just put frictionless capture mechanisms around it. And this, it just happened to work really easily. It's not expensive. Audio is easy to edit. And so I didn't set out to start a podcast. I still don't really know much about podcasts or the podcast business, to be honest. It just happened to be the thing that I like doing, which is having conversations with people. And the good thing about that is there's endless interesting people to have conversations with and learn from. And it, you can even do the same people over and over again because they keep learning and changing. So it's a very low friction, easy to use way to learn. And that's why I do it, not because I have any opinion on the direction of podcasts, although they do seem to be growing a lot. Ours has certainly, you know, grown a lot in the last year. But yeah, I'm not the smartest person on podcasts. I just find them an extremely effective way to communicate.
Knut and I started March 10th or 11th. Your dad was my first guest. Sound wasn't quite, I don't even know. It's just, we didn't care. No one was listening. I mean, I have an audience, but I don't know if they'd listen. And here I am, I don't know, 100 episodes later, great. You know, Wall Street was just so much harder than doing the podcast, and the podcast is just so much more efficient. Maybe the quality and the art of it all is different, but what I've gotten out of it is, and the fact I don't have to produce it as hard and get everything just so perfect in the editing, it just allows you to focus on the conversation better.
Yep, I agree.
So you're doing it. How many have you done?
I've done, I think 190 would be my guess, though I don't know off the top of my head. We've been doing it once a week, almost every week since 2016. So whatever that number is. And again, like you said, I find it very low burden on me personally. It's just a normal conversation like I'm having all the time. And we just happen to hit a record button on Zoom instead of not. that's it. So I think 190, and it's become a blend of founders and investors. So I started just doing investors. I've become more interested in people building stuff as well as investing in things. So I do both now. And those are, you know, the occasional stray from business and investing, but usually it's those two topics.
So you were late to geekness. You were more like into conversation.
Yeah. I don't know if I was late to geekness. I grew up really interested in technology, computers. My first job was putting together computers and teaching little kids how to do it. And, you know, was a huge video game person growing up, though not as an adult. And so a lot of this stuff has like reawakened original core passions of mine as a kid, which has been really fun. And it's just changed so much. It's cool, but I have good context because, you know, everyone's talking about Epic Games today as this huge, you know, $35 billion plus company. I was there in the very early days of the original Unreal Engine and Unreal Tournament. And I remember all these old games. So I don't know if that's geek or gamer. I don't know what you want to call it, but I've had interest in this stuff for 20 years plus myself. And so it's been neat to reconnect some of those childhood passions with what I'm doing now.
Yeah. So when I talk to you, that's interesting that you don't game. I have this thesis that we're going to have this massive investing class that'll take care of the robots, right? People don't want their robots investing, but they do today. And I'm not saying that will stop because they're printing money, but as a percentage of robots handling money in a world of creativity, and we're starting to see this with you, we'll talk about your new firm in a minute, but in this era of Substack and Twitter and TikTok and reach and engagement and podcasts and the ability to find doppelgangers around the world and network with people that can tap into your brain and the way you may be able to capture alpha. This gaming generation that you left, I mean, you're still a gamer at heart, it sounds like, can be replaced by investing. And there's a new type of gaming, which is the ultimate game, which is risk capital. And do you think that's taken up your gaming time, the actual markets?
I think that's fair. I think business and investing and the intersection of those two things is, as you say, literally the ultimate game. Like there's scoreboards, there's evolving universes. I mean, it's like Fortnite or something, you know, it never ends. And so I do think it is a replacement for all the same things that I was obsessed with in gaming, which was always competitive, not single player. So, you know, back in the day it was Counter-Strike or StarCraft or, you know, something you played against other people was what I so enjoyed. And I think that's what's now come to dominate the gaming world. And, you know, I could actually talk about the gaming market all day long. I'm really interested in it. But yes, to me, business and investing is just like a bigger, more interesting game than those ones I played in high school. But the driving competitive reasons for playing them are the same.
So I just think if you expose people to this game earlier, and legally maybe it's impossible because the SEC or something, it's such a more interesting life journey than gaming itself. Now, gaming's important. Like gamers, all the gamers say, oh, I attribute all my success to gaming. Is that what you say too?
No, I don't know what I attribute my success to. I guess to the extent I have any success, you know, very competitive and very curious. Maybe the combination of those two things are make everything I do self-sustaining. I'm not going to run out of energy for them. I think energy is sources of energy, and someone's energy is really important in anything they're doing. And those two forces, curiosity and competitiveness, are definitely my two. And I think that's why I became a gamer. Being a gamer is not why I'm competitive and curious. So I think the causality runs that direction for me.
As a kid, if you were curious, did that lead to people thinking you had no attention span because you would hop from thing to thing, or was it a good thing?
I was a very, very bad student. So, and that's largely because I hated being told what to study and learn and really liked self-directed learning, though a lot of that self-directed learning and competitiveness was channeled into games when I was young versus, you know, reading books about, you know, traditional topics. I became much more interested in all that stuff after college. So I just think I was a bad student because of that single reason. And that's where I would leave it, that you just need an outlet for those drives. And for me, it did not manifest in the way that I hope it does for my kids, which is to do well in school. But we shall see.
And if your kids were bad students, what would you do differently than your parents? Or what would you worry about? And what would you, because I have, Rachel's a great student, Max hated school, and we pushed him down the school route. I mean, we don't know what was the alternative to not school route, right? Like, so what would you worry about there?
It's a really hard question. I mean, my kids are young. They're 6 and 4. Obviously, I feel education is incredibly important. I want them to go to college. You know, I think that what I know is I've felt personally what it's like to be interested in the thing I'm learning about and what it's like to be forced to learn about things that I don't care about. And there's a gulf between them. And so I guess the one thing I do hope to do as a parent is foster and experiment with stuff that the kids might be interested in and then be really helpful to them, no matter what those things are, to help them learn to love learning in those areas. And then hope that they do a good job in the traditional schooling route. But, you know, again, I just, as someone that was always a bad student, I don't want to force something on them that I would have hated as a kid myself. With the caveat that I don't, you know, it's not going to be chaos. Like, they have to learn, the basics in major topics. And sometimes that can just suck. But I'm glad that I did. You know, I have a CFA like that. You know, that was a grueling process. I'm glad I did it because it forms a foundation of financial understanding and knowledge. So sometimes you need to take your medicine. But I do think it's important for me as a parent to help my kids find things they love, no matter what those things are, and then foster that without any judgment of what the topic might be.
Yeah, that's where I kick myself. I always want to go back and do a better job there because, you know, I grew up at a time where there was just no choice. You go to school, and I love school, but there were no cell phones. So, of course, I like school. Everybody's wired way differently. So it's just such a big change. Maybe it gets a little easier for parents, you know, from that shift to the mobile phone. So it'll be interesting because your kids are so young. So you still got 10, 12 years. I have no idea what universities are going to look like in 12 years.
Well, what's exciting is there's just going to be more ways to learn about whatever niche topic you're interested in. I mean, this is happening like crazy right now during COVID. You can learn about anything effectively for free from incredible people very quickly. So imagine 15 years from now, like this whole edifice keeps growing. So that's super exciting. And we're going to lean into that. However that looks, you know, we want them to be curious. Everyone's curious about something. We just want to find their curiosities and foster them.
And are you bullish on like you're starting this new firm, so it's called Positive Sum. So you're obviously bullish. So walk us through how you go, because I knew you had the bug. The first time I met you, I knew you had the bug. Otherwise, you wouldn't have me on your podcast, right? Like you wouldn't have had all these investors on your podcast. So you had the bug. When I met you, was like, oh, there's no doubt. Like, because I had conversations with you and your dad, and you're talking about startups, and you're talking about our fund, and you're talking about, you know, a million questions. And I was just giving you off the top of my head stuff, deep down knowing, well, it's just a matter of time before this quant stuff isn't as important to you as investing in something that you're super, super, duper passionate about. So when did the idea go off in your head that you had to be thinking about investing in early stage?
I think in all this stuff, there's never a light bulb. It's always a process. It's always sequential. And, you know, the most important first step was building some software, right? So we had made some investments in this space, again, just personally. And the most fun probably that I've ever had in my career is taking all the infrastructure from the quant business and turning it inside out, right? So I describe this as like the Amazon Web Services story, which I studied very deeply and tried to learn a lot from a lot of the people at Amazon in conversations. And sadly, not ones that I could publish. And that's basically what we did, which is to say, look, we built all this software and infrastructure, research infrastructure, portfolio management infrastructure at OSAM. Let's turn this inside out and offer these same tools to our partners, which is what we've been doing the last several years. And I think building software you know, which is really, really hard. And being operators first before investors is critical in all this, because it's developed for me a sort of empathy with what founders are going through, having been through it with our admittedly much larger and better resource team first as builders and operators. And it just all, you know, maps back to the investing always maps to business and business to investing. I love being both. I love being a builder and an investor. And so this is just a natural next step. It's not a break. It's not a jettison from the quant stuff at all. That strengthens this and this, that, you know, the reason that we've been successful in the software building side, the software we call Canvas, almost all of the lessons for how we did that, how we went to market, how we thought about product came from all these awesome investors that I get to talk to all the time. And I'm no smarter than the average, you know, really smart investor out there. That's not my edge at all. But I think I'm very good at like finding the best people, taking their best ideas and applying them without thinking too hard about it. And that seems to work really well. So it's all interconnected. There's no old and new. It's just it's an evolution of the same journey that I've been on, is the way I think about it.
And so where does Positive Sum fit in and what's the plan?
So Positive Sum is a new firm. It's a very traditional, most boring, vanilla kind of venture type investment structure that you'll ever see. We're going to invest in early stage businesses that have a very specific profile, meaning they're technology and mostly software businesses. And we'll be general, right? So there are categories we'll focus on because we know and love them. Things like investing technology, data science, data engineering, machine learning. We already talked about gaming. I'm extremely interested in gaming. And in many cases, the gamers are the developers too. So you can actually kill two birds with one stone in studying your market. And we'll look at other spaces as well. So we're not, this is not like an investing tech fund or a fintech fund, which some people expect, given our background. It's more general than that. And otherwise, you know, I won't bore the audience with the details because they're very traditional in terms of the sorts of companies that we look at, the things we care about. I think we bring obviously really unique couple of assets to the table in our operating experience, our experience with data, and our extremely wide reach via what I'll call media. And the podcast and the reach we have there. So I think we've got a very unique story to tell, but what we're looking for is the same things everyone wants, you know, big markets, amazing products, great distribution strategies that can be enormous businesses.
We talk a lot about open source. I think what fascinates me about open source, because you've had Chetan on your show from Benchmark, and I just had him on because I didn't even know who he was until I heard him on your show, and I didn't even, he's so young. But then I realized that in the open source world, he's on the board of whatever there were, open, you know, from MuleSoft to Elastic to Mongo. So it's like, there's someone out there who's under 40 who is literally at the center of the universe of this stuff, and they're accessible. And so is that what fascinates you about some of the stuff, is how early it is? Like, you know, we talk about bubble and we talk about how long the boom gone on and technology and the NASDAQ, but like some levels, the more I dig in, the earlier we are. Do you find that sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this really interesting chart that shows the kind of history with the NASDAQ bubble, and it's this aberration. It's crazy. But the trend line, you know, even with that in there, you know, it's quite stupid to bet against technology kind of through human history. And I think that will remain true. We could have a whole separate conversation on valuations. So there's some weird stuff going on in the tech world with very high prices, which is something I think about a lot. But, you know, you mentioned Chetan. That's open source is maybe the little weird niche that almost no one cares about that I'm especially interested in, because I actually view that as the model for what I'm doing with knowledge instead of source code. Obviously, you can't build as literally on top of knowledge as you can on top of open source projects, which is what makes them so interesting. But the model is very similar, which is just put stuff that you might normally charge for, you know, that a sell side firm might charge a ton for, put out there for free and have a different business model. And so Chetan, I think, is, you know, there's no argument. He's sort of the best in class open source investor, you know, Elastic, MongoDB, a lot of the biggest companies in the space, MuleSoft. And, you know, young, under 40, I think he's 33. Like he's, you know, he's very young and yeah. And has done an unbelievable job here. So, yeah, we've invested in open source businesses before. I think Chaitin's fundamental insight here, which is the most important thing for anyone listening that's interested in this topic, is that open source is not a crowdsourcing strategy. The vast majority of contributions from an open source community into a code base come from a couple people. And it's not a way to save on R&D at all. And that's what most people think, is it's like a way of crowdsourcing R&D. If anything, companies in this space spend more on R&D than the traditional tech company does. Instead, what open source does that's interesting is it's an incredible distribution strategy. So by giving a product away for free, and it's different than freemium, which I'm happy to explain if you're interested, it's different than freemium because it will last, right? It's open, the company could die, the project would live on. So it's a way of distributing your product or a free version of your product to your buying audience, developers in this case, and building a community around them. That's very hard to do, but if you can do it effectively, it makes for remarkably capital efficient businesses. MongoDB is a great example, where in later in life, because they've got those relationships with developers, they can acquire customers and build new products for very low cost. So a lot of upfront investment, a lot of hard work and effort, not just money, but effort in the early days to build that community. But that's what I love about the open source business model, is that they're thinking about distribution early on, not just product. And I think most people tend to focus too much on product and not enough on distribution.
Right. And it's the opposite of what you would say. It's like, as when I talk to Chase, I'm like, you're starting this business with no business, which is genius. It's like Larry David of software. It's like, we're just going to stumble by just giving stuff away. Stuff will appear magically at some point if what we're giving away is good. So it's kind of like freemium, but definitely different. And I like, you have knowledge as your open source, which is a great, I think you've coined that. So kudos. I called it social leverage earlier on when I discovered in 06, 07, wait a minute, I could use these networks and just be myself. And, you know, whether it's doppelgangers or whatever, and eventually I'll just turn that inside out, meaning every, like the Peloton, people can just ride on my back. Now, the risk of my strategy has always been cancer, right? Like a bad node. Someone gets into your network and accelerates in your network that you're open source to everybody around you, and it takes a while to clean that up. So it's not perfect, but like the light bulb that went off in my head, first with YouTube and then with Twitter, was okay, I'm just going to be, this is a game, and I can't play all these games, but the risk to my game is Twitter, the nightclub closes down, but I got to open source this and go as fast as I can. And not, a lot of people do this, but I just had a term for it, where I'll just turn my network inside out and see how fast we can go. And that's why I'm so excited about social leverage over financial leverage, is because social leverage is actually a strategy. Financial leverage is a tactic that everybody thought was a strategy. And I think the world is continuing to punish financial leverage. Look at COVID, right? It's not so much the economy, it's just Mother Nature this time that's punishing financial leverage. And the government's, you know, doing what it can to keep the carnivals and the airlines around, but in any normal world, those would be already restructured. You know, the financial leverage would have done them in already. So kind of a weird environment, but like, I think what you're doing with knowledge is dead on. So did you think it would be hard or easy putting on this hat, and how's the process gone?
You know, again, maybe I'm strange that like, I never think about these things ahead of time. I'm just sort of look at the current landscape and do what makes the most sense at that time. And what was happening was we were getting so much inbound and for interest from really high quality founders. And normally you'd be worried about adverse selection, that, you know, the stuff you're seeing is the dregs. But we were sort of seeing the opposite, that we were being asked to participate in rounds with unbelievable other investors, and always for the reason that we have this unique edge, right? This reach, this operator background and the data background. And so we just, again, felt the world is telling us like this is the natural next step. And when we're screamed at by the world, we tend to listen. And I certainly do. So it wasn't, again, a master plan of any sorts. The process has been like any process of doing something new, stressful. And I'm learning a ton. And you realize how little you knew about something before you actually do it. And so I've been through all that, but I've done that a lot before. I've raised funds before. I've done everything in the investing business of in some way, shape, or form in the past. So there's nothing radically new to what we're doing now. But like anything new, I've learned a ton, and it's been great, and will continue to be great, I'm sure.
What's been your favorite personal investment so far? I mean, they're all like children, but like, which one is like not surprising, where you saw it the first day and you go, no brainer. I mean, the founder's great too, but like, man, you've nailed this. Has that happened to you yet?
Yeah, it has. I mean, it's the company that where I've been the most personally involved as well. And sort of checks all the boxes. It is an open source business. It's different than a lot of open source businesses that started as an open source project and then became so successful that someone realized they should probably wrap a business around this. Instead, it's been from the beginning, both a business and an open source project. It's a business called Prefect. And Prefect, what they do is, among the more maybe boring sounding things, which is help other developers and data scientists manage their own workflows and automate their own workflows in a very elegant way. And as you might imagine, like basically all software is workflows. And the complexity and types of these things are changing and getting more interesting and complex over time. So Prefect was a founder solving his own need. His background, his name's Jeremiah. Jeremiah's background was in the data science world. He was using another open source tool that couldn't solve what he needed. He built a replacement, and all of a sudden everyone he knew started asking him to use it. And sort of the light bulb went off for him. This is several years ago. So that's a company that, again, it's in a space we know, since we do all sorts of stuff in data science as well. And the founder is incredible, an incredibly smart person with a high EQ and ability to recruit a great team. I mean, again, these are all cliches in what you look for in a business, but they sort of were all there. And it's been one of the businesses that's trained me in how to try to be helpful as an investor and not as the operator. And I've been very involved with from the early days. So that's the one that pops to mind. But honestly, there are a lot. There's another business I invested in called Steady, STEDI, which again, maybe there's a theme here, is sort of like a infrastructure, somewhat boring sounding company. EDI is a protocol for exchanging like purchase orders and B2B transactions, basically. And the founder I just found to be the most interesting. Again, it was someone solving his own problem that he had at a previous business, which he built. And it's this kind of arcane world where the tech hadn't been rebuilt in 20 years, predominantly used by Walmart and Amazon. And he's rebuilding it from the ground up for the modern era. And that I've learned a tremendous amount about software building and infrastructure and all of the company building from this founder's name, Zach Cantor. Who's become a close friend. And so, another one that stands out. I mean, there's so many interesting companies. That's the bottom line. That's why this job is so much fun. Those two come to mind quickly, but there are many others.
And is there products that you, because you, like me, have a billion things going on. What products do you use today, with the three separate businesses and the podcast? Like what are the tools that you just have to have?
Yeah, I'm incredibly boring, meaning like my life is, everyone jokes about the FANG stocks. Like my life is basically lived via their products, right? So Apple and Microsoft and Google and less so Facebook. But the big heavy hitters are the ones whose products I use. I'm boring in that sense. I'm not a huge, I'm a very lightweight person in terms of the tooling that I've used. I used to be a very different answer when I was doing a lot more modeling and hands-on work and, fancier tools. Now I'm sort of a communications person first and foremost, and I use them all. So nothing interesting that would stand out as something I do every day. The more interesting stuff I do every day is sort of offline, mostly nature-related stuff. So I could talk to you all day about that sort of thing. But in the tech world, I'm boring.
And what about notes taking and stuff? Do you have anything specific or just Apple yellow notes?
I met a guy named Shishir Mehrotra who is running a company called Coda. He was the head of YouTube for years at Google and then left to start this company called Coda. That is the one tool that I would say I'm really into. It's multi-purpose. It's Coda is a doc spelled backwards. That's where the name comes from. So it's docs, spreadsheets, and basically the ability to build apps basically inside of a web browser. And so note-taking, deal tracking, all basically anything you can do in shared documents, you can do it all in one spot. I like it better than Notion. I like it better than, some of these other alternatives, the G Suite. And so Coda, I'm a big fan of. I really like Shishir. Have learned a lot from him on the topic of bundling, which is a fascinating business concept that probably people don't know enough about. And that's the one standout I would mention that I've found myself using for as much as I can.
Yeah, these products are just a rabbit. Like, I just end up using a pen and paper. You had them on, on your podcast, so people can look up that episode with Shasir. And so when do you think you'll start writing checks out of the new fund?
Imminently. I mean, I think we will be in market and making investments right away. I mean, by the time this comes out and we've kind of wrapped up our fund, we will make aggressive investments, hopefully as quickly as possible, and look forward to doing that.
What in the podcast itself, for people that just want to dive in or just getting exposed to you through this, what are two or three that stand out over the years?
You know, it's funny. I was just, I've got a team now that I'm working with that is trying to magnify this whole effort. And so we were just looking at the ones that had been the most successful and interestingly aligns with some of my favorite episodes. So the most listened to podcast ever was my original episode with Bill Gurley, called All Things Business and Investing. And, you know, Bill's just everyone, I'm not saying anything people interested in investing don't know, but he's sort of remarkable for his ability to explain things and then implement them. So oftentimes he like straddles the what academics tend to be strong at, which is like explaining frameworks, and what practitioners tend to be strong at, which is like getting results. He seems to somehow do both. There's not a lot of people that can do that. So Bill stands out. An episode with John Collison, one of the co-founders of Stripe, was one of my favorites. A recent episode with Kat Cole, who she's the COO of Focus Brands. So this is like Cinnabon and a variety of like very simple, multi-location restaurant brands, was very different for me. And I really, really enjoyed my conversation with Kat. And then we've mentioned some of the other, this is all concentrated in the tech world, but Chaitin is someone that's been on multiple times that I learned from every time. Ben Thompson, who writes the Stratechery newsletter, is an incredible thinker. Jeremy Grantham, more recently, was great, an old school value investor that continues to update his views in a fascinating way. Maybe the most interesting one, where if you ask the question differently, which was like during the conversation as you were recording, which one made you think like, holy crap, is this going to be a good episode? It's a guy named Charlie Songhurst, who, as far as I know, has never done another podcast.
And yeah, I like that one. He's the Microsoft guy, or he's done like a bazillion.
Yeah, exactly. He used to run strategy. He was the chief strategy officer at Microsoft and turned investor, 5 or 6 years ago, I think. And just a fountain of wisdom, that guy. I mean, just so smart and articulate and different. So those would be just some. But honestly, like there are so many that I've enjoyed every one. I mean, I've learned something from every single person, from all different kinds of investors. Matt Ball is another favorite recent one. We only talked about media and the metaverse and the Marvel Comics universe and, totally different stuff. And so I'm just interested in it all. We'll try to keep it, varied. I think if it was just all tech and all software, it would get kind of boring. I do a lot of that, but we'll try to mix it up in the future.
And if there is a pullback, 30% pullback tomorrow, is there three companies that you just would buy without reading the headlines?
So here, I have a weird answer here, which is no. My answer is no. And the reason for that is in public markets, obviously price matters an enormous amount. So your return is going to come from fundamental growth or price change, valuation change. And the reason that we do what we do on the public side, which is purely quantitative, is this is just really hard to get right. You have to be incredible at underwriting a business first and foremost. And then you also need to be incredible at understanding what's priced into the stock. I don't have that second skill set. Which is why we believe so deeply in the quantitative way of implementing a strategy in public markets. I just think that's the more responsible way. It aligns with my style much better. That translates to an answer to your question, which is I don't own outright any individual public securities. Our firm actually doesn't even allow it, to keep our focus extremely clean. So in the public markets, no, there's nothing that I would be going out to buy. I would be letting the quantitative strategies do their thing. That's where all my money is in the public markets. And that's kind of not a fun answer, but it's the truth, because I just think, I know some incredible concentrated public equity markets investors. I think people can do that really well. A guy named Brad Gerstner comes to mind as a recent guest that I love his firm and approach, Altimeter. And he's great, but there's a lot that you have to get right to be a successful public markets equity investor. In the private markets, of course, valuation matters tremendously, but the variation of a Series A, price or market value is not nearly as crazy as what you see in public markets. And therefore, I think it's a little bit less important. You still want a good, fair price and don't want to overpay, because that can kill even the greatest business if you overpay. But nothing that I'm waiting to drop to buy.
Yeah, I like it. I am a quant at heart. I love picking stocks, but only on the fringe, right? Just the gaming part of it is like, I try and tell people, and obviously I'm an investor in so many do-it-yourself type things that as they relate to, stocks. But in the end, having some kind of strategy, quant or fundamental or just some set of rules is just a must have. Eventually, everybody gets there. They may have to almost blow themselves up a couple times before they get there, but people do get there. What's your general take then on companies like Robinhood versus Robo?
It's a great question. I think the, I know those businesses pretty well in each case. I think that Robinhood, and I think you're going to see a whole slew of copycats, I've already seen their decks and get more niche, in the options markets or, elsewhere. And that there's a thing that concerns me about just like the nature of trading. And if it's a small amount of money, I think it's fine and actually can be very educational. Obviously, I worry about people trading too much, which we know is bad, with a majority of their assets, which we know is bad. So I personally steer people towards, the Wealthfronts of the world versus the Robinhoods of the world, because I think it's better for their wallet. But obviously the gambling sort of and non-gambling investing that Robinhood facilitates has been far more popular than the robos have been. And the robos have done fine. A couple of them will be nice big businesses, I think. But the market has certainly voted that it prefers the more fun use case. And I think you'll see that proliferate. The number of different places you might be able to do this, it's not just equities. And so it'll be fun to watch that landscape evolve. I think the robo landscape, we're part of that. I view us as part of that at the very, very high end. We're working with ultra high net worth individuals to design very, very custom mandates, not the more sort of like 10 size fits all, that you would get from a robo. But I do think that world will consolidate and there will be a couple big key winners. And that automating is good, right? For most people, a simple automated investing plan is the right backbone of a financial plan. So I hope those companies are very successful.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great answer. Part of our responsibility is not just invest in what we like, but you have to be right. So it's an interesting thing, because what's good for the customer may not be best for the business. So that's where the investing part comes in. You can't just invest in what you love all the time. There has to be a business at the end of it. So that's kind of the interesting part of what we do. And I think I'm excited for you to go down this road. It sounds like you've been doing it anyways. Where is your, is Jim involved at all? Or is it just Patrick?
In what specifically?
Positive Sum.
Yeah, look, it's an OSAM ultimately maps back to everything we're trying to do in OSAM. So definitely, I'm certainly the lead and the person that will be the investment decision maker and originally responsible. But my goal is to extend this to other partners as we go and to find those partners that align with a couple very specific things we believe about the world, including this idea of learning in public. I think that's, if I get the question a lot with prospective investors, how are you going to beat fill in the blank, amazing venture firm? How are you going to be benchmark? And I don't know that I ever will be benchmark, but I do know that you have to do something orthogonal and different. And the thing that I'm good at that's different that other venture firms don't have is this really cool engine to learn in public. So you're starting to see this from the younger crop of investors out there, that this is becoming sort of a default strategy. And it's a great way to find people too. It's like a public resume of your thinking, which is so cool. And so, hopefully over time, this will be a multi-partner firm that works together to find these great businesses. But to begin, yes, it is me as the investment decision maker. There will be a full-time independent team that I work with at Positive Sum, experienced in the key areas, venture investing most specifically, and we'll build it from there. So, we'll see how it goes, but can't wait to get going.
What younger self, if someone wants to get investing and a career in investing, what are the things that you think could help speed them up?
I have a strange answer here, which is it's actually less about analytical work or studying businesses. And it's actually more hands-on, which is I wish that I, younger in my career, had to be forced to sell something. I think ultimately all of this, being good at any of this stuff, business, investing, and so on, often comes down to your ability to form a good argument, a compelling argument, a narrative, and to convince other people to do things. And that's selling. And I wish that, that's all I do now, is try to convince other people of certain things that I've formulated. And therefore, I wish I had gotten that experience much earlier. That's probably not the answer that most people would give in terms of how to get started in investing. And of course, you need to study, you need to lay a foundation. You got to study business. You got to study price. You have to study the history of these things to have good context. But I think the skill that ultimately separates a lot of the great investors and business people is the ability to convince others to do things. And so I would encourage people as early in their career as possible to make that a muscle that you exercise. And it can be small to start. It can be internal sales. You can convince your superior of something. But I just think you got to get in that habit, because if you don't have that skill, I think you're limited in terms of the ceiling for what you can accomplish.
You nailed it. Listen. For a while, we'll code our way out of this. I think internet and engineering got carried away. We forgot that sales and marketing matter, and sales more than marketing. When I was a kid, no internet. You went to the neighbors, washed their car. You had to close your neighbors. Then I sold Britannica at a mall, right? Good luck with a kid today trying to sell that. I hear stories about these young Salesforce kids. They make two phone calls and they want to go on a pub tour. So yeah, I think the selling, parents, if they're listening, there is no shame in selling. And then once your kids learn to sell, the next most important lesson would be go sell a product that's already selling. Because, it may be easier to sell, but you're going to be dealing with competitors who are coming at you, and you're going to have to still learn how to sell, but you might as well sell the best product out there. And generally, that's yourself, which is, now we have this do-it-yourself, invest in yourself generation. You have all this mentorship out there, but you're dead on there. I don't know how this generation gets out of this hole because of the internet. I think selling, you've got an audience of a bazillion people as soon as you turn on your phone. But those that learn how to sell, looking people in the eye, asking for an order, being stressed about you closing something to meet the number, that's something that people will wish they have at some point. Because just to rely on that is a stressful thing. Just to rely on someone else to help you make your numbers is not a fun way to go through life.
I would offer something extra though, which is many of the tools that are now available, Substack comes to mind for writers or people interested in that way of learning. There's a lot of interesting tools now that you can go start selling. Like that is a form of selling, in my opinion. Writing something and convincing people that it's good and getting them to read it and sign up for something that you've put out in the world is a form of sales. And so there's lots of very low cost internet-based ways to build this muscle. And the key is not waiting too long to get going. I think that's the challenge with like a junior position that a college kid gets coming out of school at a big investment bank or, whatever else it might be, is, you're a junior. And I think more employers are open to people experimenting like this and proving their sales ability in public forums, and that young people everywhere should take advantage of these tools, whether it's Substack or something else, because it's a low cost and very effective way with a very tight feedback loop, by the way. These are consumers you're dealing with, so it's not like making an enterprise sale. You can get really fast feedback on whether or not the thing you're putting out in the world is good and course correct accordingly. So I would just encourage everyone to think like that and try to go convince people that something you're thinking about is interesting and merits their attention.
Last question, I'm going to turn the table on you. I won't ask this ever again. You ask it every time. Answer your own question that you ask everybody.
So the question I ask everybody is for the kindest thing that anyone's ever done for them. That's my last question. And I'm trying to think of a new answer because I've given the same answer several times. I guess if I can't think of anything here in a second, I'll give my traditional answer to the question because I do get asked this question quite a lot. Look, I think it's trite, but it's not a single act. It's a relationship. It's, my parents, it's my siblings, it's my wife. Increasingly it's my kids. It's just like the shared commitment to something that's long-term that requires effort constantly in the short term to make work. And I'm thinking of my wife most specifically here. I just think there's nothing more interesting in the world than that sort of shared commitment that requires ongoing kindness from each party. And my wife has been incredible in this regard. And as a result, we've built just an unbelievable relationship, you know, 10 plus years into a marriage. And that's not any one, there's no one act that I would point to of kindness. It's just constant. I've given an answer in the past about my cousin, who's unfortunately since passed away, who introduced me to my wife. And sort of the way that he did that was just going way above and beyond the call of duty. He was an older student at Notre Dame when I showed up there. He was a third cousin. His name's Tim. And Tim, you know, I think as a cousin, he had an obligation to show me around once or twice, maybe introduce me to a few people and then push me on my way to fend for myself. But he did not do that. He spent effectively a full year integrating me into that community on a nightly basis. And introduced me, as I said, to my wife, to my best man, to another groomsman, to my whole group of friends. He and I became incredibly close as a result. And he didn't need to do any of that. And he just kept doing it. And I just thought that was an incredibly kind thing. So I'll choose those two. Tim and my wife, Lauren, stand out. Though there are so many, they can't all be named.
All right, then I have one more. How do you feel about grudges? Good, bad? Do you let them go? Do you let them power you?
I've never been asked that question. How do I feel about grudges? I think they're probably quite stupid. I try to be fueled by very positive things and stay above the fray of pettiness or childlike behavior, which you see a lot in the business and investing community. And I'm pretty good at just, you know, if there's somebody that I don't want to be associated with anymore, I just move on. I don't think about them again. If they, you know, wish ill will towards me, that's their problem, not mine. I just think you can ultimately, all my philosophy studies, like the major conclusion was I control my reaction to things. You know, the things themselves I can't control, but I can control my reaction. A grudge strikes me as something that is a massive waste of time and a wellspring of negative energy that I don't want in my life. So you know, I guess I've never thought about it before, but as I think about it, I don't have any grudges. So I guess I think they're stupid and you should ignore them.
Damn, this is our first fight. I'm all for grudges.
tell me why you like grudges.
You obviously haven't been screwed over big enough.
I've had my fair share of nonsense, so I don't think that's the reason.
Yeah, no one should get screwed over. I mean, we live in this world where you take risks like you're about to, or where I take risks, and there's just some characters out there that you just wish you had never come across.
Don't get me wrong. There's a countless rogues gallery of those. I think that the right strategy is stop thinking about them and move on.
I need a better therapist, is what you're telling me. All right. Well, I took more time than I was given, so I really appreciate it. I'm really excited about Positive Sum. And for people listening, what's the easiest way for someone to get aboard the O'Shaughnessy, you know, what would you call it, content machine, knowledge machine?
The most consistent way would just be go subscribe to the podcast. You know, it's called Invest Like the Best. Any podcast app will have it. If you do that, you'll be in my stream. You know, that's me. So if you want to learn along with me, that's by far the best way to do it. OSAM.com has tons of information. Positive Sum Advisors has almost no information. PositiveSumAdvisors.com has almost no information, but will soon. And those are probably the three places to do it. But podcast by far is the place to follow along if you're interested in the stuff we've talked about today.
Hmm. And you didn't like my podcast I did with you. Didn't come.
Which one?
You mentioned like 20 podcasts and my name didn't come up, but that was well done.
I thought it was implicit, but given my willingness to come on yours and my unwillingness to go on anyone else's.
Good answer. I appreciate your time. Excited for you. Knut.
Yes.
We're going to let him go?
Yeah, I think we should let him go. It's way past the hour and he probably has another meeting.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Patrick, thank you.
Thanks, man.
K-Nut.
Hey, buddy.
Patrick O. You met the dad, now you met the son.
Yeah. Great guys, both of them.
Yeah, I'm trying to get a six-year-old on next. We're going to talk about YouTube and marshmallows.
we'll learn things we never thought existed.
Uncle Howie is going to corrupt this. I got to find an O'Shaughnessy to corrupt at some point. He's a smart kid.
No doubt about it.
He's not a kid. So anyways, Knut, thanks for putting this one together. This has been another episode of Panic with Friends. Like Patrick says, if you want to get in with Howard Lindzen and follow my network and you find what I do is interesting, just subscribe to the podcast on Spotify or Apple or Google. You can go to my blog, howardlindzen.com. And thanks, Knut, for producing. Thanks, Darkwoods, for supporting the show and distributing it. And we'll see everybody here with another episode soon. We do these twice a week.